Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Broadcasting live from our Sanctum Sanctorum in Venice, California, this is the Sixth Sense Society. I'm your host, Krista, here with our producer, Michael. And today we are launching 2020 with a wonderful guest, Lon Milo Duquette. He is renowned in the Western mystery tradition as a writer, expert in Kabbalah and tarot and esoteric Freemasonry. He's known for a sense of humor. He is also a singer-songwriter and recording artist at 93 Records, and since 1975 has been a nationally and internationally governing officer of OTO, the Order Templi Orientis. I never say that. I always just say OTO, one of the most influential magical societies of the 20th and 21st century. So we are really thrilled to be talking to him today about one of his upcoming book that he's going to be released in February, though I think you can pre-order it, and also his reprinting of his tarot deck. But before we get going, Michael has a few announcements.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to 2020. This is our first show of the new year, and we've been looking forward to this episode and having Lon on for a while, so we're super excited about this. We're getting to 500 subscribers, and thank you guys so much for supporting us. And if you're listening to the show and you enjoy what we do, please do subscribe. It sure helps us a lot to do that. And you can follow us on our social media, on Instagram and everything, and we love having you guys do that as well. And your comments, and we will have the live chat on as well, so if you do have a question, let us know, and we'll try and pass that along during the show. Just to give you guys a sense of what we have coming up over the next little while is the next week we have Lama Kathy Wesley back on, and this was something I'd wanted to talk about, which is conflict. We see so much of that going on in our world today, and both the internal conflicts that we go through as well as all of the external stuff, and I mean even to this week, you know, blowing people up and things of that nature. So I would like to talk about the Buddhist idea of conflict and how we can resolve that more peacefully and in order to live a more peaceful life. So I think that she's excited to be doing that. And I think it'll be a fascinating show. And then the following week, we have Krista's dad back on, Dr. George Schwimmer. And he's going to be talking about the shamanic training that he received when he was younger. And I think that'll be very interesting because I think he worked with some pretty legitimate people getting some shamanic training. And I think we're all very interested in what that entailed. And then finally, our last show of January will be our new segment, Spell It Out with Krista. And she is going to be keeping it a little more freeform than what the cosmic weather was, and maybe a little astrology, maybe a little ranting, maybe a little this and that. So it's going to be a little more broad than what our last segment was last year. And we're excited about that format change too. And maybe she can tell us a bit more about that when we get back to her. And then looking ahead again to February, we're going to start with the Valentine stuff. We're going to have our good friend Holly Lindblom back on to talk about love after death and some of the ghost stories that she's researched where there's a lot of romance involved with them and so forth. I think that'll be very interesting. And then our great friend Zalima, who is going to talk about love spells, and we're going to look at some of our favorite ones and especially talk about some of the ethics and what happens when they go horribly wrong, which they do on occasion. So we would encourage you guys to be cautious always. And, you know, all magic, I think Lon will agree, falls into the category of be careful what you wish for. So I'm going to kick it back to Krista, and maybe she can tell us a little bit more about her plans with the new segment, and then we'll get on to Lon and have a lot of fun. So, and I'm sure we'll have some questions. So go for it, Krista.
Thank you, Michael, for all of that. So the little show I'm going to be doing will probably be about 30 minutes. And my idea at this point is I'm going to have a theme for the year, which I will introduce next on the first episode. And then I'm going to work sort of different thoughts around the theme, also maybe some homework for you guys. And I'm going to throw in a little astrology here and there because of mostly because of the U.S. chart. I want to keep going with that until our Pluto return. So that's it. I don't want to spend too much time because we're eager to talk to Lon. And let's get going. So hi, Lon.
Hello.
Yeah, you're there.
Yes, I'm here.
So I thought before we started talking about your works coming out that perhaps you could give us a little bit of a background about how you first even got interested in the occult or magic, whichever happened first.
Well, I guess it started when I was terribly disillusioned about anything of a spiritual nature that I was learning in Sunday school as a child. For some reason, I don't know, I'm not, particularly rebellious or anything else. It immediately struck me that all of the Protestant Christian worldview and the idea of heaven and hell and Jesus dying and going into the clouds because I was in trouble because of something that a character way in the past did with fruit. I couldn't believe that grown-ups believe this stuff. I really wanted to be spiritually, I always felt the impulse of sacredness and worship and everything, but I always just instinctively thought it was somehow centered in myself, and it was a highly personal thing. But I did. I played around, and I sang in the little children's church choir and the adult choir when I got older. I volunteered in church and was the equivalent of a Methodist altar boy. There is such a thing. I lit all the candles at the services and things like that, and enjoyed dressing up in robes and strutting around in sweet-smelling churches. But I just couldn't. There was no true mystery behind the mystery, and so I. But my father was a Freemason, and my father was one of the most noble human beings I've ever met, and not just because he was my father. He was just a very noble human being, and he was honest, and he was moral, and he was good. But he was good just for goodness' sake, not because of. He wasn't a religious man at all. He just barely allowed himself to be drug off to church. just being good and wise and moral and honest and living with integrity, he just said that's the human way to be. That's just how humans should be if they allow themselves to be human. In the 1960s, when I was in high school, I started to read articles in like Look magazine and things like that about this Timothy Leary character, Dr. Timothy Leary, Harvard professor, who was experimenting with LSD. And I read accounts of this LSD experiment with many people, and I guess when I was about 15 or 16, I said to myself in Nebraska high school, if I ever had a chance to take some of that LSD, I'm going to do it. And the second I graduated from high school in Nebraska, I moved back to California and enrolled in Orange Coast College. And immediately got a job in a saloon singing. Okay, I was a musician and a songwriter even then. And so I got myself a little job at a folk club in Belmont Shore. And one evening I walked into the bathroom during a break, and a guy said, "Hey, would you like to buy some LSD?" And I said, "I sure would," you know. And so I, after my set, I took that unknown dosage of primitive LSD. It was still in a capsule in those days. And I hurriedly drove home to my home in Costa Mesa as it was coming on. And that night, I'm not sure that night isn't still happening. it truly made me realize that everything I was looking for in God was that everything was consciousness. Okay, I was just in a wall-to-wall jello salad of consciousness, and that the key to aligning with that cosmos and that consciousness wasn't something that I would find outside myself, but only inside myself. And it was a remarkably clear revelation about what is and is not important with the life that I have, that I'm currently enjoying. And from then on, I immediately said, okay, I think this is what they were talking about in these scraps of Eastern mysticism that I was hearing in college and stuff. So I started to dig into Eastern mysticism seriously, and listening to lectures by Alan Watts, and more or less reading everything I could get my hands on in, we're talking 1966, 1967. And that more or less put me on the path I'm on right now. And for years, I thought I was going to be a full-blown Eastern mystic. And I love, and it was great timing, too, because the pop culture at the time was also taking acid, also getting into Eastern mysticism. The Beatles all of a sudden gave us a soundtrack to it. And I don't know if there was some kind of a cultural cosmic wave that engulfed the planet at the time. It certainly seemed like it. Mm-hmm. But that's more or less how I got started. And then after quite a few years of trying to be a first-rate Eastern mystic, I realized, gee, it's hard work. And I may be mystically inclined, but I'm the laziest person in the world. And I said, it just seems like I'm not hardwired to be a good Eastern mystic, because I tend to try to externalize all my internal processes. Eastern mystic strips stuff away, systematically, and go inside and remove one by one all the things they're not until they hit this divine wall-to-wall smooth point of consciousness where they actually find out exactly what they are. And I'm all for that. But in the West, we like things outside of ourselves. We like rituals. We like externalizing things. And that's exactly what ceremonial magic is. We externalize our internal processes, and instead of using abstract internal tools, we use wands and cups and swords, and so I was seeking for a Western equivalent to the profound subtlety of, say, the Tao Te Ching, mm-hmm. and Tao, and the Taoist way of looking at things. I instantly recognize that as okay, that's it. But I can't get at it like that. There must be a Western way of getting at it. And that's where I started to look for the Western way, and that brought me into contact with the Sefer Yetzirah and the Kabbalah, and the way that traditionally that the Western psyche has gone about that journey, and that so that brought me into contact with like esoteric Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, mm-hmm. Eventually out the works of Aleister Crowley and the OTO, and that's where I settled into what I was comfortably doing. So that's my short explanation of how I got here.
That's quite a journey. I really appreciate your enthusiasm around Aleister Crowley. You know, I really love the book you wrote about his deck. And one thing I really appreciated in that book was the little parts of Lady Frieda Harris' letters to Crowley. It was the first time I saw anything at all, their correspondence, and you really got a sense of their relationship, which in some ways was really quite delightful and unexpected when you see it if you don't know much about Lady Frieda Harris and Crowley's connection. And so I really like, I loved her. I mean, and I loved their dynamic, you know, I really appreciate that you included that.
So, you know, when I see characters like Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey, and see classic, kind of stuffy, eccentric English characters. Frieda Harris and that whole entourage of people that surrounded Crowley in those days, it just sort of comes alive. And I was so fortunate to have copies of their correspondence. And I thought that was that would be a nice little interesting way of making this kind of stuffy mysticism seem really homey and personal and funky. You know?
It totally brought it alive for me, especially because, you know, there's nothing really, I mean, some of it was her will. It seemed like she wanted to be invisible, which you don't really realize. At first, you think she's just being left out. But she also had kind of a distaste for some of the esoteric people at the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you and I can probably both identify with with that. You know, it's a strange combination of just, you know, brilliant, luminous stars of intellect and character, just superior human beings all around us, and then just the craziest nuts in the world, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm one of the most unlikely people to fall in love with Aleister Crowley. I have like the opposite kind of life, and I had the mystical path like you did in the beginning, but when I came across his deck is when I'd heard about him, but that's when I really was introduced to him. And I was immediately sort of interested because some woman said, oh, I never use that deck. It's dark. And I was like, okay, let me see it. I want to see the darkness. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a good selling point for most of us, actually. You know, we want to go where we think it's going to be, you know, taboo in some way. And of course it's not, but, since we're talking about the decks, let's talk a little bit about the reprinting of your tarot deck.
Yes. Okay, the Tarot Ceremonial Magic is what it's called. And this is the third printing and the third publisher. You know, I've got a Monday night magic class. Okay, we've had a weekly class in our home, Constance and I, since 1979.
Wow.
And for three of those years, it was two nights a week. And it's not just for OTO members, you know, it's our lodge, you know, sponsors it, but it's for anybody who can behave themselves for 2 hours, you know, once a week, you know. And some people, you know, eventually join the OTO and some people don't, and we forget who's who. But we've kept this Monday night magic class going. And I wanted to do a very short class series, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, just to show how these magical tables, like Crowley's Liber 777, they're just tables of Kabbalistic correspondences based on the Hebrew alphabet, you know. I wanted to show how magic, in particular, the 72 spirits of the Goetia, are assigned to the 36 decans of the zodiac. A very simple, straightforward thing, but everybody has, you know, traditionally just seen it laid out in really dry tables, mm-hmm. you know. And, I said, no, I'm going to get 36 small note cards, and I'm going to glue the sigils of the pair of Goetic spirits, one for the day and one for the night, that are assigned to the 36 decans, or periods of 10 degrees, of the zodiac. No big thing. Okay, but we could lay it out like that, and we could take the cards and sit in the middle of the floor and, you know, lay out the whole zodiac around us. And it was, and so I also put the dates and the degrees of the zodiac. I just sort of scribbled that information on it. And everybody was really excited. Everybody kind of liked that idea. They got their own 36 cards and glued their own little sigils on. That way you could tell what two spirits, you know, are traditionally associated with the day of the week that we're in right now, kind of thing, you know. And then I thought, well, you know, there's also 72 classic Kabbalistic angels of the Shemhamphorish, and these are really traditional old Kabbalistic angels, and they're allotted to the 36 decans, but in periods of 5 degrees. So there's two of those for every one of those cards too. So I scribbled their names on the cards, and the Kabbalists just went crazy over that. They like that idea, and they saw how each one of those angels could be used as a governor to the more rough and tumble Goetic spirit underneath them, and that worked out okay. And then I just finally said, okay, that would be the Two of Wands, the Three of Wands, and the Four of Wands. And this would be the Five of, you know, the Five of Cups, the Six of Cups, the Seven of Cups. Okay. And so without any trouble, because truly I'm the laziest person on the earth. I'm not joking. This is not false modesty. I'm the laziest person on the earth. And, then I realized these are the 36 small cards, the 2s through 10s of the four suits of the tarot. Mm-hmm. And then I started to think, well, there's 36 squares in the Enochian magic tables, elemental tables. And they have little squares and angels that live in them, okay? Mm-hmm. And they have little names, and they have this truncated pyramid symbol that spirit lives in. I'm going to throw that on there, too. And then I thought, well, you know, each of the Enochian tablets has four elemental quarters, one fire, water, air, and earth, and there's four court cards of every suit. I'm going to make 16 of those cards too. And so I added the 16 court cards in the tarot, had the 36 small cards. And by then it was about 9 weeks into this class, which was only supposed to be a couple of weeks. And I said, okay, if I threw together a magically oriented set of 22 trumps or greater arcana, I'd have a complete tarot deck. And so it took about a year after that to gather all that information. And then, and I'm not an artist. I'm too lazy to be an artist. But I did the best I could with line drawings. And my wife, Constance, I gave her a sheet of paper that said, for each one of the cards, which colors were Kabbalistically appropriate for each of those cards that included planetary colors, zodiacal colors, mm-hmm. and plus the colors associated with the emanations or Sephiroth on the Tree of Life. There's very strict color coding.
Yes, right.
Because I thought, you know, if someone is as lazy as I am and they don't want to even learn any of the technical information, they will still get this information vibratory-wise through the cones and rods of their own eyes. And just by playing with the cards, they'll get the magic of the, of the cards. Does that make any sense, you know?
Totally, because to be honest, I am catching up on the intellectual side of Kabbalah. My husband and I, we taught ourselves mostly the layout of the Kabbalah with Crowley's system. We memorized the pathways. We didn't have any intellectual Kabbalistic background, and we just meditated on the relationship of the cards. And I know the astrology part, but
we
actually came up with a system that is fairly sound, according to a Kabbalistic rabbi that my husband accidentally sort of met at a party, and he wanted my husband to explain what we knew based on the layout, the diagram. So the diagram and the card, and we used, I am completely probably fascinated with Crowley's deck more than ever in the last 10 years. So I generally just use his cards for the most part. And I agree with you, the visual, if you remember to keep looking at the cards, because, you know, sometimes you think you know them and you don't look at them. It stimulates you. It's there's no doubt of the cards that were designed. They were designed to do that.
And you've learned the Kabbalah, and the only way the Kabbalah can be learned is you taught it to yourself. And it's something that if the right seeds get planted in you, they grow on their own. And everybody's Kabbalah is uniquely their own. Mine isn't yours or any, but if you actually get the right seeds that start to attune you in the right way, then the Kabbalah literally grows in you. It blossoms in you, and before you know it, you're embodying it rather than grasping it intellectually.
It's true, and I think that what I really appreciate you saying about the deck that you have created with your wife is that you honored the correspondences, and I'm a bit of a snob when it comes to tarot decks at this point. I think decks in general are beautiful, like oracle decks, but I really get quite perturbed by what some people call a tarot deck, because it really has no connection to the lineage at all, whether it's, you know, Marseille deck lineage, whether it's the occult lineage, and you just don't get as much out of it.
Yeah, and first of all art is magic, okay? I don't put down anybody's art of anything. All artists are magicians, and all magicians are artists, if they're really magicians. The art in itself is a magic, but when that art is synchronized to perfection of some kind, and the tarot, much as I hate mathematics, I was too lazy to study it. the tarot and the Kabbalah deal with the mathematical harmonies of nature and existence. And if you have that, have art married to that perfection, you've got potentially omnipotent magical tool in your hands. And you know, I tell people, you know, if you order, put your tarot deck in order, that's the universe, that's the well-oiled perfect universe, that if you truly understood it, that's the way you would see it. But when you shuffle your tarot deck, okay, that's the way you're currently seeing it now. <you know?
laughs> I like that. That's true. And,
yeah, and it's not that that everything isn't still there. It's still we're seeing everything a little out, or a lot out of whack.
Yes.
So anyway, the U.S. Game Systems in 1991 was my first publisher of the deck. And they did two full runs of the deck. So I believe there was 20,000 that they went through. First, they did two printings of it, two full printings. And bless U.S. Games. They had a great distribution thing, and for many years, it might have been 15 years, but they finally let it go out of print. I think they, when they ran out of their stock, they figured they're going to quit while they're ahead, and it was several years, many years, before a friend of mine who published my novel, Accidental Christ, said, let me try to publish it for you. And he worked his butt off and went through all sorts of printing hell with a Korean, I believe, printer, and did a very, very, very small edition. And he had to sell them for like $65. And still, I'm sure he lost money on the thing. And so it's been out of print and on eBay for like $700 and stuff like that, of which I get nothing of, you know. And so finally, and I've got other publishers like my good friends at Weiser, who's really my main publisher. They were not into publishing tarot cards and not excited about doing tarot cards. They printed the book that goes with it, and that book has always remained in print, called Tarot Ceremonial Magic. And then finally, a good Mason friend of mine in Omaha, Nebraska, that is the CEO of Next Millennium Distributing, which is a big occult and mystical supply distributor in the country. And he did an insanely beautiful job of getting it reprinted. The colors are insanely good, and it's in a two-part box, you know. You lift the lid, and the box will last for forever, instead of the, you know, the thumb thing that you immediately tear off the lid of, you know.
Right.
My wife and I just couldn't be more pleased. And it's got a beautiful green border, like the felt top of a pool table, kind of. Oh, it's so cool. They can sell it for a normal price, which it hasn't been a normal price for 25 years. And it's again available, and it's on Amazon now too. And they call it Tarot Ceremonial Magic Next Millennium edition.
That's wonderful. You can also buy it, I saw, at magicalomaha.com. Is that correct?
Magical Omaha. That's probably the best way to get it.
Yeah, I saw that on your Facebook.
And they also sell the book from Weiser on that same place if you don't have that. But it's really fun because you can immediately pick it up, immediately find your birthday card. There's a court card of the 30 degrees you're born in, mm-hmm. and there's a small card for the 10 degrees you're born in. It's very intuitive. You can pick it up and all of a sudden just start playing with it, and before you know it, you've learned a whole bunch of Kabbalah and a whole bunch of magic at the same time.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I'm going to order it. I have not ordered it yet. I also have a small, well, I have like 100 decks. I think I collect a little bit of the tarot.
Yeah.
And it's getting a little crowded in I love even, like I said, cards that I couldn't read with personally, but like it is an art. Tarot is art. And that's what it started out as, is art. And I agree with you. You're much kinder than I am about. I get really frustrated sometimes when I see certain things. I'm like, that's not a tarot deck. It's like, why are they calling that a tarot deck? And that's my own little, pet peeve.
Yeah, I know. You could just say, well, it's a perfect whatever it is, but it's just not a perfect tarot deck.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the book coming out in February. Allow me to introduce An Insider's Guide to the Occult. That sounds like it would have an appeal to many people.
Well, that's what I'm hoping.
And it's timely. Because it's become, the occult in a lot of ways is becoming sort of mainstream, maybe with television and things. And it'd be great for people to even know what that is that might not know what the occult is.
Well, first of all, the occult or magic or the Western mystery tradition, that's probably the most polite umbrella term to put to everything. It's a huge subject with a long and varied background that forms the foundation of it. I mean, everything from alchemy to astrology to, tarot to even what people think is black magic and demonology and things like that. There's a huge background to it, and it seems like when you start to study it, it's like you're jumping in the middle of something, that there is no magic 1A,
True.
And it seems like you're jumping in the middle of it because you are. And in a sense, you never stop thinking, oh, shoot, I should have been educated in this field in order to better understand that. There never comes a time when you stop saying that to yourself. So if you're saying that to yourself right now, forgive yourself.
I have always been saying that to myself. I feel behind on things I didn't know I was behind on.
Yeah. So I've only been writing since about 1988. Before that, I never, considered, myself prepared or capable of writing. And it's only I was drug kicking and screaming into this career by Dr. Christopher Hyatt. And we wrote four books together in 1990 and 91. Mm-hmm. But when I was a kid, and I mean a kid from 18 to 28, for those 10 years, I was lucky enough to read and study selected works, everything from William Walker Atkinson's series from the turn of the century. He wrote as Yogi Ramacharaka. But people like Paramahansa Yogananda and mm-hmm. Alan Watts, and finally when I allowed myself to get into Crowley, there was a book called QBL by Frater Akkad, and then there was Israel Regarde's classic Ceremonial Magic, his Eye in the Triangle, which introduced me to Crowley in a sane way. And so these were the books that actually started to make sense to me. And when I joined the OTO in 1975, I almost immediately met and came into contact with, because he was almost a neighbor of mine, Israel Regarde, who was Crowley's secretary during the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And he wrote all of these classic works, Eye in the Triangle, and Ceremonial Magic. And these were the works that actually put things in perspective to someone even as dense and as lazy as myself. And as the years went by, I was fortunate to make the acquaintance of a lot of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Before they died, anyway, most of them. And as the years progressed, and the interest in them and the interest in me started to slowly increase, in popular sales and stuff, I've had the opportunity. I've been asked by the publishers of their works to write sort of a modern view and a modern introduction to their works, and so I've had the great privilege to be able to comment on in a small essay, 1,200 words or less. Comment on the importance of their work. And so over the years, I've written many, many, many introductions to all sorts of works, classic works of on Kabbalah and Tarot and Thelemic magic and Enochian magic and sex magic and magic and Freemasonry. And so finally, I guess it was last year, I called up my publisher at Weiser, Mike Conlon at Weiser, who's a dear friend, and I said, look, some of the best stuff I've ever written are the introductions to these classic works. They're short little pieces. I've had to actually encapsulate the not only the meaning, but the entire significance of this entire body of work in just two or three pages of stuff. And I have to put it in perspective and make it palatable enough as almost as an appetizer to properly give credit to and to introduce these great works. And I said, it's the best stuff I've ever written in concentrated form, and it's the least things that ever get read. Admit it, when you buy somebody else's book, you may read a little bit of the introduction, but you really want to get into the other author's work. Okay?
Oh, not me. I'm a writer. I look at the acknowledgments. Look at the introduction all the time. If they give away the ending, which one book did in a Dickens novel,
it gave away
the ending. I was like, what? So sometimes I wait
don't
at the
do
end.
That.
You're not supposed to do that. But, you know, I think... you know, the readers will read everything, but you're right. Most people don't. And they even skip, like in astrology, they'll skip all the way only to their sign.
To their sign, yes. So I said, I'll gather them together. I've got the rights to all this stuff. I can't imagine myself going to my grave by having what I consider some of my best stuff slip into oblivion. I said, I would really like to write a book or to compile a book and just simply call it Allow Me to Introduce.
It's a wonderful idea.
And so that's they hemmed and hawed. They hemmed and hawed and but they said, finally, yes, let's do it. And I'm so excited about it. And they've sort of exploited the Rolling Stones, sympathy with the devil. Allow me to introduce Matt Dill.
Yeah. That's right.
And then they've got a beautiful cover to the thing with a Baphometic thing looking really cool. But it's I'm truly excited about it. And to tell you the truth, one part of me is actually heaving a sigh of satisfaction that I probably won't go to my grave without this, without these, the best of my little jewels. At least out there in an edition. So please, everybody, buy, order. You can go to Amazon right now and get Allow Me to Introduce.
That's right. There are pre-orders right now. Is it released in February 1st? Is that correct?
I think it's February 1st, but that means we should be seeing it any day now.
Right.
Yeah.
But yes, they're pre-orders. And yes, I totally agree. Especially now that I honestly didn't know what it was going to be about. I didn't look at the blurb. And now that you say what it's about, too, it can also be a good way to see the great works, you know, and that you might not be aware of, especially people that are starting out or even people that are involved. There are always things that you can discover that you might not have known about.
Right. Well, the subtitle just does really. It says an insider's guide to the occult, which is exactly what it serves to do. But it is so much more than that, or at least from my point of view, it's so much more than that. And it's one of those things that I've got it arranged in. In parts or sections. One of them is like teachers and heroes and mentors. And then my classics of magic, and then Kabbalah and Tarot, and then Thelemic magic, and then Enochian magic. So it's something that you could give yourself permission to jump around, read what sparks your curiosity first, and it's not necessary to read it, you know, from front to back. Mm-hmm. So
cool.
Put it in the bathroom.
Yes. So before I forget, you can find Lon on Facebook. That's mainly where you can find him and his books on Amazon. He has actually a really good author's page under Lon Milo Duquette on Amazon, which I found very easily. And, you know, for someone that's so lazy, I got to say, you did write quite a lot of books, and let alone teach class and give lectures. So, you know, I hope many of us aspire to be as lazy as you are.
Well, thank you. I just quickly, I won't take too much time. I went to China 2 years ago and I did a lecture in Beijing, and on the way back they to the airport, they said, "Hey, can you come back every 90 days every season and do a 4-part Kabbalah class?" And I said, "Sure." How am I going to do that? And but that's what I did for an entire year. I went every season to Beijing, and I created a small sort of off the wall, goofy initiatory society. And I remember me talking about planting the seeds inside you to let it grow. Mm-hmm. You know, the seeds that I planted every 90 days was the Hebrew alphabet. And so I made a little initiatory society with secret handshakes and grips and initiation ceremonies and study programs for the 3 mother letters, the 7 double letters, and the 12 simple letters. And then we had a graduation type thing. And I really worked my tail off because I had to stay one step ahead of my class, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And so when I came back from China after the fourth trip, I had all this material already available. So I called up Weiser and said, I would like to publish this material as the Son of Chicken Kabbalah. And so that was last year's book, The Son of Chicken Kabbalah, which is like volume 2 of my Chicken Kabbalah series. So
I just picked that book up, actually, The Chicken Kabbalah. I just read the beginning of it. I really like it so far. So
you'll love it. So. And when you're through with that, get Son of Chicken Kabbalah and initiate yourself.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. You definitely have a sense of humor, you know, that, which is, you know, we were talking about earlier, my husband and I, that sometimes there's not enough humor in any spiritual tradition, and yet how crucial it is.
Well, you know, I don't see why there isn't, because it's all pretty funny.
It's funny. I
said stop and think about it. It's all really hysterical. So
it's funny. I said at one point I was going to create my own church, and I was going to call it Temple of the Fool. And got a URL and everything. And I said the main tenet of the religion was going to be that to attain oneness with God can only happen when you can take nothing in life too seriously, including the religion itself. So that was the main purpose of it, was to get people to sort of lighten up just a little bit. And I think sometimes we're guilty of taking things in the occult way too seriously, and it sort of causes lots of problems. So if you lose your sense of humor, I don't see how you can possibly attain oneness with the divine with no sense of humor. So I agree with Krista on that one.
So I tell people, no sense of humor, leave my tent.
Yeah, especially as I've gotten older, humor saved my day, I have to say, you know, which doesn't mean that you can't take the teaching seriously, you know, but I guess it has a little to do with ego and, you know, the overemphasis on ego, which seems to be maybe a shadow of the Western tradition, since the Eastern is trying to, you know, diminish ego, but the Western maybe is still working on how to effectively deal with ego, in at least my opinion.
And one of the first steps of dealing effectively with your ego is to definitely not lose the ability to laugh at your own self and laugh at your own ego. I think it's a very divine quality.
Yeah, it's true. Not taking yourself too seriously. which I think some people think, you know, maybe you're putting yourself down, but that's not the case at all. It's different. You know, that's not a good thing either.
Yeah.
That's not healthy.
Right.
Low self-esteem. It's not a good thing. So we have about 5 minutes or so, and I wanted to know if there was anything you would like to advise or anything you like to talk about just off the cuff a bit. I certainly have a couple questions if you don't have anything in your mind, but just to give you a chance if you want to talk about anything.
Oh, well, let's go to your question.
Well, okay, so I have a very peculiar question. Since I studied witchcraft first, and I, you know, I'm a person that doesn't have a label. I've just decided it's okay. I don't have a label. And but I had the impression, at least at times, that magicians did not always like witches. And I don't remember where I read that. And I don't know if that really happens these days, but they do seem to be very different magically. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about, like, the difference between a witch practicing magic and a magician. Is there really? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I think it's a holdover from the how each of the schools of thought were developing in, say, the 70s and the 80s, and maybe the 90s a little bit. The idea of magicians sort of being Kabbalistic snobs, and they're like indoor magic, because we were all in love with the idea of the Golden Dawn, people strutting around indoors, mm-hmm. strutting around in the dark with cool robes and Kabbalistic lingo. And there was a, sort of an intellectual snobbery associated with that. And that and they were sort of uncomfortable with the more visceral right hemisphere, I guess you could call it, outdoor magic of witches, and both of them refusing to more or less see the truth that Gardner and Crowley were partners in creating both of those things, and magicians sort of look down their nose at witches, and witches sort of look down their nose at magicians. But it was only a matter of time before the survivors of both of those systems learned enough and grew enough to see that there was absolutely nothing to look their nose down upon. And indeed, that the witches were, in their own way, performing very viable ceremonial magic, and that the ceremonial magic magicians were, in the same way, aligning themselves with the earth and the seasons too. Mm-hmm. So, it's truly a matter of, well, if one doesn't like the other, then one of them certainly doesn't understand the other or themselves.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I hadn't thought about it like that. I just kind of noticed it, you know, and that makes a lot of sense, actually. And of course, like you said, I think there's a little more blending at this period of time.
If I can jump in just really quick, guys, just because we have a comment from on our live stream or our live chat, and someone wants to know what Mr. Duquette feels about people who tattoo sigils on their skin. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
They do what on their skin?
They tattoo sigils on their skin.
Oh,
magical
well,
signs and so forth.
Yeah, people are free to do whatever they want. I personally wouldn't want to do anything so permanent with something like a spirit sigil or anything like that, unless, of course, I wanted to sort of attach myself to that that concept. So I'm not opposed to it, and if they think it's a magical act, worthy of that kind of a commitment, then that's I think that's perfectly all right. But as far as if I wanted to whip up a demon to go do a specific job of heavy lifting in my life, like a Gwaishik ceremonies are usually done to do something very practical in your life. I think that would be a bit of an overkill.
That could cause some problems. It seems like.
Well, it would entail a great deal of a lifetime responsibility. In the same way that, let's say you went to the animal shelter to get a rescue pet, and the pet that you chose would never die.
Oh.
Or leave you.
That's a good analogy. Well, I think we're closing out now. I want to thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for your time and generosity. And we hope you'll come back at some point in the future. And thanks again.
Okay. Thank you guys for giving me the chance to talk.
All right. And thank you all for listening in. We look forward to you next week. We'll have Lama Kathy again. And until that time, keep studying and have a great week.